And have a seat, please. Good morning on this nice, crisp Wisconsin morning. The case we have on for hearing today is Johnson versus Wisconsin Election Commission et al., 2021 AP 1450. What I'd like to do is start out with appearances in the order of presentation. It's my understanding each will have 30 minutes at the outset, followed by 10 minutes, likely, this afternoon in rebuttal. If that's not your understanding, when you make your appearance, please let me know. All right.
Good morning.
Good morning. You've already been admitted pro hoc vitae, true? Okay. Very good.
Good morning, Your
Good morning. And you have been properly admitted pro hoc vitae. Thank you. I like dotting the I's and crossing the T's at the beginning instead of when you're about to argue.
Yes, Your Honor. Michael P. May, of Martin Clark, Lawton. You represent the group known as the Citizen Mathematicians and Scientists. That's Sarah Friends, Sarah Hamilton, Stephen Joseph Wright, Jean-Luc Foucault, and Sonia Shachat. With me is my co-counsel, Sam Birch.
Good morning. All right, thank you for that. All right, good morning. Good morning, all. I take it then we have the lineup correct, and we also have timing correct, since no one suggested any other time limits. So we will start out this morning with Rick Essenberg beginning the argument.
May it please the court. The Johnson petitioners have largely been concerned with process. We believed, given our federal constitution, structure, and allocation of power, that there was a strong presumption that this matter should be heard in state court. We argued that to protect the institutional role of the courts, certain principles should govern consideration of the maps. And we believe that this court's November 30th, 2021 decision is consistent with those principles. For that reason, we did not believe it was necessary for us to prepare yet another set of maps to vie for this court's approval. This places us in a unique position this morning, the only party arguing without a map to propose. But I'd like to suggest that in light of the proposed maps, and the subsequent briefing, that there are five principles that we would ask the court to keep in mind in considering these maps. First, population equality or deviation does not drop out of the case as long as it is within a so-called 2% safe harbor. Two, Just as maps with varying degrees of population equality or deviation may be lawful, maps with varying but close degrees of core retention may comply with this court's lease changes mandate. 3, lease changes is not simply a function of core retention, particularly given the choice by the governor and others to minimize the equalization of district population in order to provide room for the manipulation of certain boundaries. 4, a 7th majority minority district is not mandated by the Voting Rights Act. And 5, even when maps are broadly within this court's lease changes mandate, court may consider whether those changes comport or whether those maps comport with the traditional redistricting principles for the purpose of deciding which one of a number of lawful maps to choose. Let's turn to the first principle. Population equalization does not drop out of this case as long as it is within a 2% safe harbor. This case is about population equalization. It's about remedying malapportionment. This so-called safe harbor referred to by some of the parties is a rule of deference that is applied by federal courts being asked to review state legislative maps. It is a principle of federalism, and significantly, these federal courts do not apply this safe harbor and greater leeway in assessing population equalization when they are reviewing federal legislative, that is, congressional maps.
Mr. Essenberg, I'm going to ask you if you would to skip ahead. I'm not sure which number it was. I wasn't able to write my numbers down as fast.
I'll get there.
You could tell me which number the 7th district not needed was. That's what I was going to ask you to focus on.
Absolutely.
So in reading your brief, what I read it to say is that we're not sure about how the VRA would impact Milwaukee and the 7th district because we didn't hire an expert to do so. The Black Party did hire an expert, and they went into a very, very in-depth analysis showing the need for a 7th district in Milwaukee, 7th majority-minority district in Milwaukee, and, in fact, indicating through their expert that if there were that additional district, that it would impact the abilities of the Black voters to be able to elect a candidate of their choice. What do you have to say to that? How do you refute that? Because I don't see anything in what you have submitted that goes through the type of analysis that Black went through. So I guess just my question is like really blunt in a way. How do you know? How do you know you don't need a 7th district?
Well, and it's a good question, and my response is as follows. I don't think they make out a prima facie case for violation of the Voting Rights Act. They don't make out a prima facie case for the addition of a seventh map. The Voting Rights Act does not mandate proportionality, and it does not establish a rule that one must create as many majority-minority districts as one possibly can. Nowhere in the expert reports that have been submitted by the Black defendants and others do they explain what happened in the last 10 years that requires an additional majority-minority district, other than the fact that they think that they can now draw one. And quite frankly, the reason that they can draw one is that they reduce the percentage of Black voting age population in each of these districts. Which itself is an odd thing when we're talking about the Voting Rights Act, because particularly, and most of the time, when we're talking about a Voting Rights Act case, because there is a presumption or a finding that minority voters have somehow encountered a barrier to participation, and that's the key for the Voting Rights Act. There has to be a barrier to participation, and I think the Brinovich case recently made that clear, in which the Supreme Court explained that equal opportunity and equal participation are not different requirements, and that there must be some type of barrier, some type of special thing that has to be done for minorities to participate, or some special obstacle that has to be placed in the way of minorities. It's not simply a situation where you analyze to see whether minorities can elect candidates of their choice. So there's no explanation of what additional barrier was put into place in the last 10 years that would require the drawing of a 7th district. And in fact, the very fact that the block defendants and the governor now believe that you can create a minority opportunity district with 50.1% BVAP suggests that there are no obstacles to black participation in the electoral process, because typically in the Voting Rights Act, we're talking about the need to create a supermajority in order to overcome these obstacles. And the fact that they say now, and this is the only way that they can get to a 7th district, that a supermajority is no longer required, suggests that there are no barriers that would support the drawing of a 7th district.
I'm sorry. I want you to finish if you have another.
The other thing I would say is that when you look at the particular discussion of barriers in the report submitted by the governor and the Locke defendants, they typically refer to things that haven't happened. They talk about voter identification as a barrier to participation. But voter identification is a perfectly lawful requirement that has been upheld by the United States Supreme Court and, in fact, this court. They talk about the Eric Movers list, something that I know a little bit about. I brought the case.
I am going to, because I think you've answered the question as I understand
sure.
it. I want to know what your current position is with regard to the VRA, the Voting Rights Act. A few weeks ago, when you submitted your reply brief, on page 7 of your reply brief, you stated, the petitioners have no current position on whether the Voting Rights Act requires an additional minority-majority district because all of the evidence needed to determine that answer is not available to the petitioners, and the petitioners have not engaged an expert specifically to review that issue. My question to you is, does that remain your position that you had a couple of weeks ago? Is that still your position today? I heard you respond as though you had a position, and 2 weeks ago when you filed your reply brief, you say you didn't have a position.
We had to see what the other side put in. We don't have, had they made out a prima facie case of a violation of the Voting Rights Act, then we would not have engaged an expert to assess that.
This was in your reply brief.
That language was in the brief. That language was in the earlier brief, I believe.
Page 7 of your reply.
Because we talked about Brinovich in our most recent filing, and what we said there is that if you look at the Brinovich decision, which it didn't arise in the redistricting context. In Brinovich, the Supreme Court says, look, we're going to go back to the language of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And what we need to have here is some type of obstacle to political participation, some type of unlawful obstacle to political participation. Dissent can't simply be seen as a mandate steps be taken in the regulation and government of the electoral process that maximizes minority electoral success. That what we need to do is identify some type of barrier to participation. And that barrier to participation, we began to talk about some of the things that in the Block report, I don't think that they amount to a Voting Rights Act violation that would require the addition of a 7th district. And
I have two questions, Mr. Essenberg. The first is, you keep saying require the addition of a 7th district. You make it sound like 6 districts were approved by the courts. Isn't it true that the only thing Baldus dealt with was the Latino districts, that the claims regarding black voters were after trial were withdrawn. So there was no finding by any court that six districts was enough, right?
There was no litigant who, that's right. There was no litigant in Baldus. I mean, initially, they made this assertion that a seventh Black Opportunity District was required, and then they dropped it. I would assume that if the court chooses from one of the maps that are been proposed by the other parties here, that there will be these six opportunity districts, because everybody has proposed at least six opportunity districts. I know that there's a disagreement as to whether or not one of the legislature's districts can qualify or not. So,
well, 10 years ago, seven might have been appropriate as well. There was no litigation of that. So when you add six, you're...
Well, it's true that no court made that decision, but I would think that if there was a case that could have been made for the addition of a seventh district, that somebody, some litigant, would have made it. You know, there was a great deal of litigation following the drawing of maps in 2011. There was at least two different challenges. And, you know, I think what they did do, though, in Baldus is kind of interesting, because what they did in Baldus is they said, look, you have created the 8th Assembly District in Milwaukee, and you haven't put a sufficient supermajority of Latino voters into that district. And it wound up, after the court had redrawn the district lines, it wound up that there were 70% Hispanic voting age population in Assembly District 8 and over 60% Hispanic citizen voting age population. And this is the type of supermajority that we normally see when we're talking about implementation of the Voting Rights Act, because by definition, if there's a barrier to the participation of minority voters, then something has to be done to overcome that particular barrier. But when you say that we can create an opportunity district with only 50.1% of the vote of black voting age population in a district, this strongly suggests that there is no barrier for black voter participation because no supermajority is required, and that comes from the black defendants and the governor themselves. And if you look at the report that was submitted by the black defendants, again, you have voter ID, it was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in this court. You have a discussion of the ERIC movers list.
Counsel, well,
I'm going to ask you, go ahead, Justice Agnorn.
Thanks, Justice. Counsel, do you believe that the Voting Rights Act applies at all to the black voting population in Milwaukee?
Well, it applies in the sense that, one can attempt to make out a case that the jingles, as somebody that taught election law, I'm embarrassed to admit that I can never remember whether it's gingles or jingles. But you can make out a case that those factors are met. Here, however, it doesn't seem like a case has been made for the addition of the 7th District, particularly when what you're doing to create that district is reducing the percentage of black voting age population. And so, you know, it applies, but in this case, a prima facie case that would justify the addition of this map has not been made. And, of course...
Are you saying... I just want to follow up on that. Are you saying the prima facie case... I'm hearing you say two things, and I want to make sure I understand them. Are you saying that the prima facie case has not been made, one, because there was nothing illegal going on in Milwaukee? Because you keep referring back to the ERIC voter list, and you keep referring back to the voter ID, which I agree with you, neither one of those, both of those have found to be legal, that there is nothing ill. But certainly Block lays out and their experts lay out and all the ways that African Americans in Milwaukee have been discriminated against when it comes to voting. So that's my first question. Are you saying it has to be illegal? And my second question is, you're talking about this, the reducing the percentages, the 50% or the 50.2 or 50.6. It is above 50%. Is there a line for you of where it needs to be above? I'm not sure when you say supermajority.
I wouldn't say there's a line, but I would say this. much of what we see in the report and in the briefs, and I think, you know, the argument is somewhat underdeveloped in the briefs, has to do with general societal discrimination and racial disparities. But that in and of itself can't support a Voting Rights Act remedy. That would run contrary to a whole line of Supreme Court cases, ranging from Croson to Shaw versus Hunt to Parents Involved, which make quite clear that general societal discrimination and racial disparities are insufficient for a race-based remedy.
I was going to ask a question. Go ahead and finish here.
Question then becomes, do we have in these reports evidence of obstacles that would be sufficient to warrant the remedy that is sought here? And, if in fact voter ID violated the Voting Rights Act, then I don't think it would have been upheld by this court or the United States Supreme Court. The Eric Mover list is something that it's absolutely true that Rex Flagg moved them. And I should know that because I brought the case that suggested that the voter rolls be maintained in a different way. And unfortunately for my clients, I lost. And so it seems to me that, you know, there's a lot of complaints about local administration of election in Milwaukee County, in a county which has a majority minority common council.
Mr. Esmer, what would you have them bring forward? What would you have them bring forward? When I look at Block, I look at their submissions, they talk about the history of official voting-related discrimination in Milwaukee and in the state, that voting in Milwaukee is polarized along racial lines, that there have been voting practices that enhance the opportunity for discrimination against Black voters in Milwaukee, fewer polling places for one, and the voter ID law, which you have referred to, that African Americans in Wisconsin disproportionately bear effects of discrimination in employment, education, health, criminal justice, and incarceration, all of which hinder their ability to participate in the political process, that political campaigns around statewide and in Milwaukee are often marked by subtle and overt racial appeals, and that most elected positions in the Milwaukee areas, particularly those outside of Black majority districts, are not held by Black office holders, despite the fact that there is a large African-American population in the area. What else do they need to show you?
Well, what I would like to see is extant barriers to electoral participation.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but what Justice Kurofsky was discussing are, in fact, factors that go to the totality of circumstances. Do we even get there? Because, first of all, there are three preconditions that must be met. So in responding to Justice Kurofsky, could you address whether you believe that the preconditions are met to establish a seventh Black Opportunity District?
I think they're not. And the reason they're not on the face of this report is that one has to show not only racial block voting, but one has to show that this voting usually results in the defeat of candidates that are preferred by minority voters. And I've tried Voting Rights Act cases, and I have seen the kind of disproportion that will normally support a finding of a violation of the Voting Rights Act. This is 3 out of 7. This is 3 out of 7. I just don't think, I mean, that's almost 50-50. I mean, that's what you kind of expect if things were even, because you can't, you know, I mean, somebody's going to win the fourth election and somebody is not. So I think it's extraordinarily weak evidence with respect to the proposition that that this racial block voting will usually defeat candidates preferred by minority voters.
And as a follow-up question, of course, I don't think we've heard any discussion of the Equal Protection Clause, which of course prohibits a state without sufficient justification from separating its citizens into different voting districts on the basis of race. Could you address the interplay of the Equal Protection Clause with application of the VRA in this case.
Right. And this brings us back, I think, to Brinovich. Again, Brinovich was not a redistricting case. It has to do with certain election administration rules in the state of Arizona. But, Brinovich makes clear that that this is not a guarantee of proportional representation, that this is not a guarantee of electoral success, and that a violation of the Voting Rights Act cannot be sustained by these totality of circumstance factors, these jingles factors, that rely on societal discrimination and the continued existence of racial disparity, because that would create a constitutional problem.
Counsel, I just want to be sure you didn't step on your tongue as you were talking, because equated the jingles factor with the totality of circumstances. And as I read the case law, the jingles factors have to be met before you ever consider the totality of circumstances. Am I wrong in my reading?
Justice Rogatzak, I indeed stepped on my tongue, and thank you for pointing that out. The problem is that if we relied on this evidence of racial discrimination and racial disparities, we would run afoul in order to impose a Voting Rights Act remedy, which is a race-conscious remedy. We would run afoul of constitutional principles that prohibit that. And so if you look at the court's jurisprudence with respect to the 14th Amendment, the court has made absolutely clear, I just won a case in the Sixth Circuit. The court has made absolutely clear that one cannot point to societal discrimination and racial disparities and use it to justify a race-based remedy. That violates the 14th Amendment, and there are numerous cases, beginning with Bakke, Shaw versus Hunt, Croson, parents involved that established that.
Counsel, I wanted to follow up on my earlier question about the Voting Rights Act, whether it applies at all, because I didn't read any of the briefing to challenge whether the Voting Rights Act applies to the black voting age population in Milwaukee. I hear you making that argument now, what I'm trying to figure out is if that's true, then all of the maps that's submitted all explicitly take into account race in drawing black opportunity districts in Milwaukee would violate what I think you're laying out, right? Or if I'm not understanding it correctly, let me know. And let me add one other piece to this. My reading of the law on this, and again, I feel free to correct me if I'm in error, but is there race conscious district drawing? Yes. The answer is yes to every map that we received. Yes. So what's the reason for that? Well, it has to be compelling interest. Compelling interest can be the Voting Rights Act. And the way the Supreme Court said it in Cooper is that there has to be at least good reason to think the Voting Rights Act would apply in that context. So there has to be some space for some latitude here. We have everybody seems to think that six districts is good enough, but if six districts, if the jingles preconditions aren't met, then six districts seems problematic too. So help me understand that position.
That would be true. That is not a claim that anybody has brought in this case, so it's difficult to see how it would all sort out when it hasn't been raised by any of the parties or briefed. But it absolutely is true, I think, that in the absence of the proof of factors that would support a race-conscious remedy, that a race-conscious remedy cannot be adopted.
The Gingles, did you get it?
Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if it's Gingles or
like
Jingles.
You
might like
the 1985.
Anyway, your time is fleeting. So, as I understand it, and I'm a linear thinker. So if there is a